You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Please welcome AFA's Central Florida, Martin H. Harris Chapter President, Todd Freese.
Thank you. 36 years ago, our chapter established this great symposium and has been working closely with AFA to keep it one of the premier professional development events for airmen. Today is our honor to participate in continuing that great tradition by hosting this session. I am pleased to introduce our keynote event to conclude our symposium. Lieutenant General John Thompson is responsible for approximately 6,000 airmen worldwide. He commands an annual budget of over $7 billion to support the research, design, development, launch, acquisition, and sustainment of satellites and their associated command and control systems. Accompanying General Thompson is global innovator Elon Musk. In 1983, he taught himself computer programming at the age of 12, sold the code for a BASIC-based video game called Blaster for approximately $500. In 1995, he started Zip2, a web software company later renamed PayPal in 2001. But more recently, you might know him for revolutionizing electric cars as CEO and product architect of Tesla Motors. Development and manufacturing of advanced rockets and spacecraft for missions to and beyond Earth orbit, as founder of Space Exploration Technologies, SpaceX, and conceptualizing high-speed transportation known as Hyperloop. And if you haven't heard some of these quotes by Elon Musk or Muskisms, let me introduce this one. Here's my first one. When I first read it, I thought, while it applies to innovation, it's also written into the contract of every airman in this room and every man and woman who has served. The quote is, if something is important enough, even if the odds are against you, you should still do it. Now, looking back to our speech this morning by Dr. Roper, when he talked about innovation, one of the Muskism quotes is, failure is an option here. If things are not failing, you are not innovating enough. But my favorite quote, I would like to die on Mars, just not on impact. General Thompson, Mr. Musk, over to you. Thank you. Thank you. Welcome.
Well, Elon, thanks so much for being here today. As you know, and many people in the audience know, we're reprising a fireless fireside chat that we did at Air Force Space Pitch Day back in November. I ran into General Goldfein, the Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force, this morning, and maybe I was being a little bit too confident, but I said, hey, I think that we did such a good job together at Space Pitch Day that Elon and I got invited back for a much bigger audience, higher stakes and everything like that. And General Goldfein looked at me and went, no, JT, you guys are gonna do it until you get it right. So we're gonna talk a little bit today about innovation. For those of you in the audience that nothing that was introduced about Elon made it to the prefrontal cortex, and you're like, I still don't know who this guy is. You may remember him from a movie role in Iron Man 2, or the TV show The Big Bang Theory. You may remember him, if you're old like me, when you used to have to do dial-in modems. You may remember how PayPal actually worked over a dial-in modem.
Yeah.
And if, just in case you've had your head in the sand for the last decade, you absolutely have to know him for Space Exploration Technologies, SpaceX, a tremendous partner of the United States Air Force in the space business, and for Tesla. So for just for grins, this fastest growing auto company on the planet, most amazing capability. And when Elon pulled up he and his entourage in three different Teslas this morning. How many Tesla owners do we have in the audience? Stand up if you're a Tesla owner. All right. Very nice.
The sector is.
So, Elon, you and I have talked about whether the Air Force is the most innovative service. The Department of the Air Force now, the last time we interviewed, it was just the Air Force. Now we're the Air Force and the Space Force as part of the Department of the Air Force. Most of those people who stood up were in the front row. We have a lot of first adopters here in the front of the audience, apparently, or maybe those are the folks that just make the most money. Who knows? Okay, so... again, today's discussion is about innovation and how we can make the Department of the Air Force the most innovative department within the Department of Defense and perhaps across the United States government. So, Elon, question number one. When you put a weapon system or a product into production and you start delivering it to your customers, very, very frequently there is a pushback within the production organization that, you know, we don't want to change that product too much. It's successful. We have a lot of legacy systems that we're responsible for in the Department of the Air Force. There is a lot of reticence at times to incrementally improve or add new capabilities to those systems. From the context of Tesla and SpaceX, how do you motivate your workforce? How do you work with your customers? How do you work with technologists in your ecosystems, your various ecosystems, to try and make sure that products don't become stagnant and they continue to incrementally improve over time?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me here. It's an honor to be here with you and with everyone else from the Space/Air Force. I've obviously had a long relationship with the Air Force and very much appreciate the support over the years. So I just want to make sure to say that. And look forward to doing a lot of interesting things in the future. I think it's actually... it's cool that there is, that the creation of the Space Force is happening. I think it makes sense that there's a major branch for every domain, you know, with that, and so the domain of space in the domain of error are both important, but I think space is certainly a medium of its own.
Sure.
I think there's some very exciting things that are possible. If I may just say, like, what the public wants, I think, and actually I'm pretty confident that the public does want this, is a Starfleet Academy. You know, like, yeah, like how do we make Star Trek real? You know, that'd be pretty amazing. I'd love that. You know, so I think like the fastest we can make sort of Starfleet real, then we should try to do that.
Elon, speaking for the United States Space Force, there already is a Starfleet Academy. It's the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Sure. Yep, I've been there. I've given a talk, and the first launch of Falcon 1, we had a Falcon sat from the Air Force Academy. That rocket blew up, but then the funny thing is that it blew up. Here's this truth is stranger than fiction. The satellite was shot through the fairing, arced through the air a couple hundred meters, and then plunged through the roof of a tool shed, and then landed on the floor. And was actually in reasonably good shape. I mean, for crashing through the ceiling, but you know, you're like recognizable, you know. And we gave it back, and so we've not lost one of your satellites.
So from a SpaceX perspective,
buff it out.
A partial mission success.
Yeah, it's like, well, it's not lost. I'm just saying, it's a little worse for wear, but you know. But here, but then we subsequently launched future Falcon sats to actual orbit. That was great. I think we can make go a long way towards making Starfleet real and making these sort of utopian or semi-utopian futures real. But it will definitely require radical innovation. One can't get there by incrementally innovating expendable boosters. There's just no way.
Yeah.
So I think we need to push for radical breakthroughs. And if you don't push for radical breakthroughs, you're not going to get radical outcomes. And that does mean taking risks. Common sense that if you take a big risk, in order to have a big reward, there must be a big risk. It's most of the time you cannot find big reward for small risk. Those are rare. So you're going to have some proportionality of the risk and reward. But if the goal is important enough, and I think increasingly the goal is important for many reasons, the goal of having the best technology in space, that is, I think, going to become increasingly important, and it'll be increasingly important for the United States to use what I think is its greatest attribute, which is invention and innovation, to create space technology that is the best in the world. In fact, I think if the United States does not use breakthrough innovation, it will fall behind. Yeah. So I think this is not something that was a risk in times past, but I think is a risk now.
Okay. Do you characterize that risk in terms of peer adversary competition around the planet? Are you suggesting that it's our adversaries that require us to be those radical innovators? Or is it just we can't become complacent and stay incrementally improving our systems. We must take those giant leaps forward as a nation, regardless of the competition.
I think there's little. I have zero doubt that if the United States does not take, seek great innovations in space, it will be second in space.
Okay.
With as sure as night follows day. So it is a big deal. But this is a very innovative. There's no country more innovative and inventive than the United States. So it's just important to use that attribute. That's the ace card.
Okay.
Yeah.
And since it seems like we're going down the geopolitical path here on the questions, how does the United States as a nation maintain that innovative edge, that ability to invest in things and take those risks? What kind of governmental policies or processes do we have to encourage the right kinds of behavior, in your view?
Well, I think having outcome-based procurement is actually very important.
Okay.
So you say, like, this is the outcome that is sought, and whoever can achieve this outcome or achieve this outcome to a greater degree, that company will, that's who the Air Force will do business with, and will procure the thing that is radically innovative as measured by what is important for leadership in space. I mean, I do think it's absolutely fundamental to achieve full reusability in access to space. This is the holy grail of space. At the point at which you have full reusability for orbital rockets, then you have a profound advantage over anyone else. It's profound. It would be like if in the Air Force, if you had planes that could be used once, or if you had multi-use planes that could be flown over and over again, like normal, and all your adversaries had single-use planes, that would be no contest. It's the same thing in space.
Okay.
Yeah, this is extremely fundamental. So the cost of propellant is typically on the order of 1% of the cost of the vehicle, or less. So, if you have a vehicle that is, say, box kerosene, like Falcon 9 or something like that, it's the oxygen and the fuel are, maybe $500,000 or something like that. But then, depending upon the mission, the mission price can be anywhere from like $60 to $100 million. So, Falcon 9 is a partially reusable vehicle, but not fully. The vehicle we're working on right now, which is quite difficult, is Starship. And that has the potential for full reusability. But I think it would be great to have other companies as well that are doing full reusability. I think competition is a good thing. Mm-hmm. It may seem at times that, shouldn't we focus all our efforts on one system and rather than divide them and have two competing systems? Not to cause controversy, but in my opinion, like, Joint Strike Fighter, there should be a competitor to JSF. I know it's a controversial subject, but I think it's not good to have one provider. It's good to have competition where that competition is meaningful, and somebody can actually lose.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in radical innovation, obviously the workforce is a really key component of that. I mean, during your PayPal days, you were actually doing coding, mm-hmm. right? But in SpaceX and Tesla, they are so large that Elon can't do everything. What sort of things do you think about in terms of motivating a workforce like we have in the Department of the Air Force that will help them become more radically innovative? What sort of things do you look for in people or in processes that make the workforce better?
Sure. Well, I think the massive thing that can be done is to make sure your incentive structure is such that innovation is rewarded and lack of innovation is punished. There's got to be a carrot and a stick. So if somebody is innovating and doing making good progress, then they should be promoted sooner. And if somebody is completely failing to innovate, not every role requires innovation, but if they're in a role where innovation is should be happening and it's not happening, then they should either not be promoted or exited. And let me tell you, you'll get innovation real fast.
Okay. The stick.
Yeah, it's like, how much do you want?
Yeah. So does that carrot and stick approach help, do you think, people be more risk averse or less risk averse?
Well, when trying different things, you've got to have some acceptance of failure, as you were alluding to earlier. Failure must be an option. If failure is not an option, it's going to result in extremely conservative choices, and you may get something even worse than lack of innovation. Things may go backwards. If what you really want is risk you want reward and punishment to be proportionate to the actions that you seek. So if what you're seeking is innovation, then you should reward success and innovation. There should be minor consequences for trying and failing. There should be minor. Significant rewards for trying and succeeding, minor consequences for trying and not succeeding, and major negative consequences for not trying.
Okay.
So if you have that incentive structure, you will get innovation like you can't believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've talked at Tesla shareholder meetings and in various interviews that you consider the machine that builds the machine,
yes,
to be just as important, if not more important, than the machine itself.
Yeah.
So we talked about the workforce aspects. Are there processes that you use within your company that are parts of that machine that you think are particularly valuable for innovative, radical change?
Well, what I mean by the machine that builds the machine is that the production, designing the production system of a new product is, I think, at least an order of magnitude or two orders of magnitude harder than designing the initial prototype.
Yeah.
And I think, like, in America, there's been less importance in modern times placed on manufacturing, and I think this is a mistake. At this point, I would really classify, and in fact, I sent an email to SpaceX just saying this. Like, at this point, I think designing a rocket is trivial, just trivial. There's like tons of books that'll, you read them, you know, you can understand equations, you can design a rocket. It's real easy. If you say like two-stage and 2% of your liftoff mass to orbit, to design something like that, piece of cake. Now, if you say you want to go into production with that, or if you want to actually make, let's say the next step is you want to make even one of those things. Okay, now making even one of those things and getting it to orbit is hard. But the designing of it is not hard. The making of it, of even one, is hard. The making of a production line that builds and launches many is extremely hard. Mm. And then the next level beyond that would be creating a fully reusable system and having that be in volume production and volume launch. That's super, super hard. But by building a machine that builds a machine, I mean creating the production system. And I keep emphasizing to SpaceX, the hard part is making it and making lots of them and launching frequently. Because reuse must not just be, it can't be reused like the shuttle. It's got to be rapid and complete reuse. So the shuttle was a case where the reuse was very slow and it was not complete. The main tank was lost every time, and refurbing the shuttle between flights was extremely expensive. It's not even clear whether it was worth recovering the booster shells from the ocean. So just like an aircraft, the rocket must be rapidly and completely reusable, and then you need lots of them. And then I've been sort of just doing back of the envelope of what's needed to establish a self-sustaining city on Mars. And these are like big numbers, but I think you need on the order of 1 million tons to the surface of Mars, useful payload, something like that. Mm-hmm. Because we sit on the top of a massive base of infrastructure, or the economy is, you think of all the things that are mined and then refined, and then there's many steps in the refinement. And in order to produce like your phone or your toaster even, there's a vast base of industry that was required to produce even a simple household item. It's very difficult. So you've got to recreate that on Mars. So 1 million tons on Mars means, and we're just talking orders of magnitude here. And hopefully it's not 10 million tons, and hopefully, maybe it's less than 1 million tons, but probably not 100,000 tons. So that means you need to get about 5 million tons to Earth orbit of useful payload. So you're talking so essentially, unless you have a launch system that is somewhere in the megaton per year range mm-hmm. to orbit, it's not relevant.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Starlink, as you're scaling to build more and more Starlink satellites to go on more and more reusable rockets, what are some of the challenges you've had to overcome in Starlink production so that you can perfect that machine that builds the machine?
Yeah, Starlink production is going well, actually. That's a hard thing to get right. We had many iterations on the Starlink prototypes. And then, as I said, then building the Starlink production line was, I don't know, 1,000% harder than designing the satellite to begin with. But it is important to have like a, to design for manufacturing and have a tight feedback loop between the design of the object and the manufacturing system. So when you design the object at first, you don't realize all the parts that are really difficult to manufacture. And so having the manufacturing system and the design bring those up at the same time so that you're actually, in the beginning, making a thing that you know is wrong, but you're actually figuring out what's hard to manufacture. Okay. That's the real problem. So we brought up the Starlink production line before we actually had the design finalized, which is actually the right thing to do. And then we discover, there's all these things that in the design that are very difficult to make. And so therefore we must change the design. And the satellite ended up having the same capability, but just was very easy to make and launch. So, well, real, I say very easy. It's sort of hard, but it's being done. And the satellites are being produced at a rate now faster than we can launch them. So, and the cost of the satellite has dropped below the cost of transporting it to orbit. So even when taking the Falcon 9 in the most reused configuration, which is you get the booster back and you get the fairings back, the cost of the of transporting the satellite to orbit exceeds the cost of the satellite.
Hmm.
So the satellite's in a good situation.
Okay.
And the cost of that satellite will keep coming down as we ramp up rates and make design improvements. But we really need Starship to carry Starlink in order to get the total delivered cost to orbit to be much better than it is today.
Okay.
Which is still pretty good.
In terms of deciding what to build, you can take feedback from customers and let customers pull to you what they want, or you can be radically innovative within your company or, you know, a small set of individuals.
Sure.
And develop something and push it into the industrial base. So customer pull would be Tesla owners wanting new features on the existing fleet. Push would be, you know, company push would be something like when Apple pushed the iPad to everybody and nobody knew what an iPad was until they touched it and went, wow,
sure.
Everybody wants an iPad now. What do you all think about in terms of that balance between customer pull and company push?
Well, in the beginning, nobody wanted a Tesla, I can tell you that. When we made the original sort of roadster sports car, people were like, well, why would I want an electric car? That's my gasoline car works fine. I'm like, no, electric car is better. I should try it. And it was hard, you know, hard to get people to do a test drive. First of all, nobody knew who we were. They'd never heard of this company. And I'm like, yeah, we're named after Nikola Tesla. You know that guy? Nope. So for sure we were doing push in the beginning because people said there was no one telling us that they wanted an electric car. So it was not out of like, you know, it was like lots of people coming up to me saying, hey, I really want an electric car. I heard that zero times. So people were like, it's like, man, we're going to make an electric car and show that these things can be good. And then people will want them. You know, it's like, I think it was like Henry Ford said, like the, you know, we talk about the Model T, it's like if you ask the public what they wanted, they'd say a faster horse.
Mm-hmm.
So if you did like a big survey and said, well, hey, public, before automobiles, what would you like? It's like, well, I'd like my horse to go 3 miles an hour faster and eat less food and, you know, be stronger and live longer and that kind of thing. There'll be basically a bunch of incremental improvements on horse. Because people, when you say like, well, what about an automobile, that car that drives itself? Like, what are you talking about? That sounds crazy. But when you actually make an automobile and give it to people and say, okay, now this is a horse where you can keep it in the barn, and if you leave for a month, it's still alive. Yeah. So carry more weight than a horse and go further and that kind of thing. So, anyway, it's like when it's a radically new product, people don't know that they want it because it's just not in their scope. I think when they first started making TVs, they did a nationwide survey. I think this might have been like 46 or 48. It was like a famous nationwide survey. Will you ever buy a TV? And it was like 96% of respondents said no.
Hmm.
Some crazy number. Like basically everyone's like, would you buy a TV? And maybe they put a price in there or something. I don't know. But it was famously, almost everyone said they would not buy a TV, but they didn't know what they're talking about.
So the big game-changing stuff at the beginning is a company push kind of a thing most of the time. But
yeah.
Then changes to the product over time can be a lot more customer pull kind of a focus.
Yeah, changes to the product over time can be incremental changes. Then customers can certainly tell you, it's good to get customer feedback to say, how can we improve the product? And once they're using it, they can say, okay, I like this thing about it, I don't like this other thing, and then we can improve the product over time. Customer feedback after they have the fundamental thing is great.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so in the audience here, we have a lot of air and space warfighters. We have so people who use systems. We have a lot of developmental teams on both the government and the industry side, and we have the air and space leadership of the nation. So I got a little lightning round here for you.
Great.
To try and influence maybe some of those younger folks in the back who are looking for the next big thing. So in terms of different kinds of technology, whether it's artificial intelligence or medical or batteries or whatever, in the next 5 years, what technology do you think will see the most advancement?
Well, it's difficult to assess most in those contexts because they're very different, but I think probably the most transformative, most fundamentally transformative will be AI.
AI, okay. And if you were recommending to some of the young officers and enlisted troops in the room, what sort of degrees to pursue at college or what sort of education that they should prioritize for themselves in the modern era, what would you recommend?
Computer science and physics.
Computer science and physics, okay. How many computer science people do we have out there? How many physics people? Okay, we need more, apparently. Okay.
I mean, it's essentially information theory and physical theory. If you want to understand the nature of the universe, and have very good predictive power, physics and computer science.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. As a nation that is interested in radical innovation to maintain its competitive edge, what are the things that the Department of the Air Force should be investing more in other than reusable rockets,
right,
from your perspective?
Again, I can't emphasize enough how important reusable rockets are. Yeah. You'll love it. it's great. And I think that you could actually do point-to-point on Earth to go long distances and be much better than aircraft. Because, I mean, basically, just think of like ICBM minus the nuke, add land, you know? So it's just sort of in the option package, just, you know, uncheck nuke and then add landing system. Check. And that's definitely going to get you wherever you want to go the fastest. Because that's why they made ICBMs. They get there the fastest. I think that's going to be pretty exciting. Once you have a dramatically lower cost access to space, then many things are enabled. You can think of, like, once you got the Union Pacific Railroad, then, you know, getting to the West Coast was much faster and much less dangerous.
Yeah.
You're not likely to sort of end up eating your compatriots in a snowy situation. So you can just take the train. in the beginning they thought, why the heck are they building that stupid railway? There's nobody there. And they're like, but once you build the railway, they're like, okay, now it's easy to get to the West Coast, and now a huge portion of the U.S. population is on the West Coast. And actually, California is the most populous state in the nation, but it used to be, well, least populous, I suppose, or pretty low. Many things are possible once the transport problem is solved. That's why I think it's so fundamental. if you can't get there, or getting there is takes a long time, and you can't risk, and every mission's got to work, it's very hard to innovate.
Yeah.
It's got to be that, okay, some missions won't work, and the cost of running the experiment is low. That's why I'm harping so much on the cost of transport. Once you're there, I think, say, establishing a base on the moon or base on Mars, there's just a tremendous amount of work that's needed to create a self-sustaining base on the moon or Mars. And it opens up a tremendous amount of opportunity, just as the Union Pacific Railroad did, by making access to the West Coast much easier.
Okay.
Outside of the space realm, I think there's still a lot of opportunity in tunnels. I've been saying that for a long time. And tunnels are great. They're really great. Boring Company is about to finish its first tunnel in Vegas. I encourage people to copy. Please copy the Boring Company, or do better. That'd be great.
So in terms of domains, you have subterranean.
Yeah.
Obviously, Tesla covers the ground domain as capabilities. You've got the space domain covered with SpaceX and Starlink capabilities. I think this is the Air Warfare Symposium. Folks in the audience might be interested in if you have any ideas for the air domain specifically.
Well, for the air domain, I think things are definitely going to go into kind of autonomous, locally autonomous drone warfare is where it's at, where the future will be. Now, I'm just saying, I want the future to be this. It's just, this is what the future will be.
Okay.
Is autonomous drone warfare. And at a local level, can't believe I'm saying this because this is like dangerous, but it's simply what will occur. Is drones locally being autonomous but I think we still want to retain sort of the authority to damage or destroy anything that isn't an autonomous drone. Keep that authority back here. With a person in the loop.
Okay.
But it's the fighter jet era has passed. That is, it's just, yeah, the fighter jet era has passed.
Okay.
So it's drones.
Yeah. Let's go back to failure for a minute, and the mindset that you have, you and your leadership team at Tesla and SpaceX have on failure. I mean, the SpaceX blooper reel that you guys did in, sure, I think it was 2017 timeframe, was definitely, hey, we embrace this learning that occurs. More recently with the Tesla truck and the ball through the window, that mindset that embraces failure. How do you personally? I mean, those kinds of failures would drive a lot of us in this room nuts, but it doesn't seem to drive you nuts. Seems like you're very comfortable with it. Can you talk about the mindset that requires for you to be that accepting of that kind of failure?
Sure. Should we roll the video?
No.
Or should we not?
No, we should not roll the video. Not yet.
Okay. I think of these things as just, there's a certain amount of time, and within that time, you want the best net outcome. So for, all the set of actions that you can do, there's going to be, and some of which will fail, some of which will succeed, and you want the net useful output of your set of actions to be the highest. I mean, to use a baseball analogy. Like, you know, baseball, they don't let you just sit there and wait for the perfect pitch until you get a real easy one. They didn't give you three shots. And on the third one, they say, okay, and they get off the, and they go back to the, put somebody else up there. So you're three strikes on the baseball, not on bat anymore. So what you're really looking for is, like, what's the batting average? You know, how you doing on score? And there's going to be some amount of failure. But you want your net output, net useful output to be maximized. Okay. Failure is essentially irrelevant unless it is catastrophic.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Intellectual property. Obviously, Tesla, SpaceX, SolarCity have amazing capabilities that they're bringing to the public and to the government every day. How do you protect your intellectual property in a world where it seems like the cloud and servers and things are constantly under attack from people wishing to free you of your intellectual property?
Yeah, well, actually, at Tesla, we just open-sourced our patents some years ago, so anyone can use our patents. So we really have not been tried to protect intellectual property in that sense. We've tried to actually smooth the path, because the overarching goal of Tesla is to accelerate the advent of sustainable energy. And so if we created a patent portfolio that discouraged other companies from making electric cars, that would be inconsistent with our mission. So we open-sourced all the patents in order to help anyone else who wants to make an electric car. So I guess that's the opposite of protecting the IP. Now the real way I think you actually achieve intellectual property protection is by innovating fast enough. If your rate of innovation is high, then you don't need to worry about protecting the IP, because other companies will be copying something that you did years ago, and that's fine. You know, just make sure your rate of innovation is fast. Speed of innovation is what matters. And I do say this to my teams quite a lot, that innovation per unit time. It's like innovation per year, if you want to say it, like, is what matters. Not innovation absent time. Because if you wanted to make, say, 100% improvement in something, and that took 100 years or 1 year, that's radically different. So it's like, what is your rate of innovation that matters? And is the rate of innovation, is that accelerating or decelerating? And a weird thing happens when companies get big is that most companies or organizations, the bigger they get, they tend to get less innovative. Not just less innovative on a per-person basis, but less innovative in the absolute. And I think this is probably because the incentive structure is not there for innovation. It's not enough to use words to encourage innovation. The incentive structure must be aligned with that. That's fundamental. So,
taking that from a business level to a national level, in terms of obviously the United States, largest economy in the world, China, the second largest economy in the world currently and gaining fast, what sort of things that could you share with the audience here that are your thoughts on the competition, economic or military, between the United States and China?
Sure. I think China's a real interesting country, I have to say. The thing to appreciate about China is just that there's a lot of really smart, really hardworking people there, and they're going to do a lot of great things. This is sort of you know, independent of Chinese government policy, they're just going to do a lot of interesting things. The thing that will feel pretty strange is that the Chinese economy is going to be probably at least twice as big as the U.S. economy. Maybe three times, but at least twice. And that assumes a GDP per capita still less than the U.S. Since they have about four or five times the population, then it would only require getting to a GDP per capita of half the United States for their economy to be twice the size of ours. And as I'm sure people in this room know, the foundation of war is economics. And so if you have half the resources of the counterparty, then you better be real innovative. If you're not innovative, you're going to lose.
I'm not sure whether that's a cyber attack that's ongoing or not here, so. The clock says I have 11 minutes left. Is that not true?
He's got some smooth.
All right, smooth jazz, Elon.
It's coming through the house system. We're working to get it shut off.
Okay. Thank you.
Hotel. Yes, well, anyway. with respect to China, China's economy is going to be 2 to 3 times the size of the U.S. economy, at least double. Therefore, in order for the U.S. to be competitive on a military level, the innovation has to overcome a gigantic gap in economic output.
Okay.
So in the absence of radical innovation, the U.S. will be militarily second.
Okay.
Basic math.
What, from the standpoint of radical innovation, we already talked about workforce, we talked about processes, we talked about protecting intellectual property rights. Let's talk about overall culture. That culture that you try and push into your companies that makes them successful. Any of us, and I sat right next to one of your SpaceX employees on the plane here yesterday, a young engineer. It was motivating for me just to talk to her about what she was doing every day and how important her job was. And I just felt like the only other place I've seen that kind of culture is, frankly, in the Department of the Air Force with some of our young folks that are sprinkled around the back of the room. How do you create that culture at SpaceX and Tesla to make employees like that?
Well, wow, this smooth jazz is just on us with a vengeance. I feel like we're in a big elevator. First of all, when we interview people, we do ask for some evidence of exceptional ability, which in most cases includes innovation. This is not to say that everyone needs to be innovative. But we certainly need those that are doing advanced engineering to be innovative. And ideally, everyone is at least to some degree innovative. So at the interview point, we select for people who want to create new technology, and then the incentive structure is set up such that innovation is rewarded. Making mistakes along the way does not come with a big penalty, but failure to try to innovate at all comes with a big penalty. You'll be fired.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. The carrot and stick.
Yes.
That's the stick.
If you don't even try, somebody doesn't even try to innovate, or their innovation aspirations are not very good, then they will no longer be at the company.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. All right. So we got about 5 minutes left, and what I'd like to do is just turn it over to you, Elon, to talk about whatever you'd like to talk about. If you have a message for the audience here, you have 1,000+ air and space professionals and the greatest air and space force on the planet. So what do you want to tell them?
We got to make Starfleet happen. So we want real big spaceships that can go far places, and that's probably get me into the most trouble of all. I think this should be a new uniform. Cool uniforms, cool spaceships. I think that's what when the public hears Space Force, that's what they think. It's like, okay, we're gonna have some sweet spaceships and pretty good uniforms and stuff, and that's what the public wants. We want the sci-fi futures, the good sci-fi futures, to be real, and ideally to become real while we're still alive. And we want to see it happen. And so I think we really need to drive the rate of innovation to be such that we would see big breakthroughs, big improvements in space technology in the years to come. So, yeah. So, just try to make Starfleet happen as soon as humanly possible, and definitely while we're still alive. Yeah. So, I'm not sure about warp drive, but other stuff I think can be done.
Gotcha.
Warp drive and teleportation, probably not, but big spaceships that can go far places, definitely that can be done.
Understood.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, Elon Musk.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.